This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. The English actor Jeremy Irons has been described as the thinking woman's pinup for his handsome looks and his sophisticated, elegant style. He's currently starring opposite Al Pacino in a new film version of The Merchant of Venice. Irons plays the merchant Antonio. Pacino plays the moneylender Shylock. A.O. Scott in the New York Times called Irons' performance quietly mesmerizing. We'll hear what our film critic David Edelstein has to say later in the show. Irons first became known for his performance in the British TV adaptation of Brideshead Revisited and went on to star in The French Lieutenant's Woman, Moonlighting, Dead Ringers, M. Butterfly, The Mission, Lolita, and Stealing Beauty. He won an Oscar and a Golden Globe Award for his portrayal of Klaus von Bülow in Reversal of Fortune. Terry Gross spoke to Jeremy Irons in 1998.
Well, I'd like to play a couple of clips from some of your early films and talk a little bit about your acting career. And I thought we would start in 1981 with your movie The French Lieutenant's Woman, in which you played opposite Meryl Streep. The movie was about an actor and an actress who are having an affair while they're making a movie set in Victorian England. And in the film within a film, you play a gentleman who's engaged to a fine middle-class woman but becomes romantically obsessed with a mysterious fallen woman played by Meryl Streep. I want to play a clip from an early scene of the movie within the movie when your character is calling on the fine middle-class woman who he intends to marry.
I came here this morning to inquire whether you would allow me to ask your father for your hand.
Yes, I would allow it.
Mind you, I don't know that he altogether approves of me. After all, I don't do what he considers to be work.
Are you suggesting that it is entirely Papa's decision?
No, it is yours.
Yes, it is. Papa will do what I want, and I will do what I want.
Well, in that case, might you take pity on a crusty old scientist who holds you very dear and marry me?
Oh, Charles! I've waited so long for this moment.
Now, how did you act in the movie within the movie? Did you see this actor as a great actor giving a great performance, or did you see it as a mediocre performance? Did you want your acting to be really different in the movie within the movie than it was when you were playing a contemporary character?
No, the movie within the movie, as you call it, although I would say that is the movie. And the relationship between the actor and the actress is the outer movie. But the main story, the period story, is about a man who becomes obsessed with this woman who may or may not be telling the truth. A woman quite outside his social circle. This is a Victorian time when, you know, social circles were very important and you didn't really move outside of them. It was about obsession at a time when you really couldn't behave like this. That had to be absolutely real. And then the actor and the actress who weren't having an affair at the beginning of the movie, as you introduced it by saying, the actor became obsessed with the actress because of his relationship with the character in the film. And we see this happening many times. I mean, it is not rare for actors to fall in love with their co-stars during the making of a movie.
Why do you think that's true?
Well, it's very... If they're playing a love story within the movie, the barriers between reality and fantasy in a real relationship are difficult to draw. If you are filming a film relationship, those boundaries are very, very shady, and I think people often fall in love with the character that the actor or the actress is playing. It's a strange area. I mean, if you're experienced, if you've done it a lot, you know what it's about, and you know more clearly, you recognize the boundaries. But you know, you often see young actors or actresses doing that, and then the movie's over, and after sort of 4 months, the relationship dribbles to a halt because they're both off playing different relationships with different people or in different stories.
Now, you've experienced the opposite, too, where you've played opposite your real-life wife. How does that affect things when you already know the person inside out, and then you're...
Well, that's strangely difficult because... You're right, I made a movie called Waterland, playing husband and wife with my wife. And the characters we were playing were very, very different to our characters in life. And normally when you start building a fantasy relationship with an actress, you start with a bare page because you don't know them. And so you both build up this relationship, this history, this what you have between you. If, as my wife and I did, we had, I don't know, 20 years of history in our relationship, you have to try and scrape that board clean, wipe off the chalk marks of your relationship so that you have a bare board upon which you can start building this new relationship. Now, the wiping off of that history is very difficult because, I mean, how do you do that? The way we did it was that my wife moved out. She moved into a hotel, so she wasn't the person making my breakfast in the morning. I would meet her in the makeup chair in the morning, and I'd meet her as I would meet any actress. And we tried to create a relationship that was totally different. And even if we were staying, we filmed some of it in Philadelphia, and we stayed in the same hotel but on different floors, and we wouldn't meet. We would meet sometimes in the corridor for a cigarette.
Did you both agree this would be a good idea?
Yeah, I was unsure about it because I like having her about. But she was absolutely sure, and the director was absolutely sure, and he was quite right. But at the end of the shooting, well, towards the end of the film, she finished before I did. And she called me and she said, "Can I move into your suite now?" I said, "I'm not so sure about that. I think I need to finish this movie on my own." But eventually, she persuaded me.
Let me move on to another movie that you starred in. And this is Reversal of Fortune, the 1990 film in which you played Klaus von Bülow, who was convicted of attempting to kill his wife, Sunny, by injecting her with an overdose of insulin.
He wasn't convicted. He wasn't convicted.
The first time,
accused.
In the first trial.
Oh, right, beg your pardon.
In the first trial. And the movie is about the appeal in right. which he was represented by Alan Dershowitz, who's played in the movie by Ron Silver. And in this scene, Dershowitz has just taken on the case, and he's asking von Bülow, played by Jeremy Irons, to tell him what happened.
Okay. I gather, though, the older children denied Sonny had a problem with pills and alcohol?
Spectacular understatement.
So there must be somebody who saw it, right? Some witness, somebody somewhere, a friend.
You want affidavits?
Yes, I do.
I'll get them.
You'll get them.
You should also know that the drugs prescribed for me were taken by Sonny.
It's a lot of drugs, Klaus.
But the prosecution's allegation that I knew about syringes injections, totally accurate. Sonny and I used to give ourselves B12 injections in the late 60s. It was quite a fad in London.
Can I explain something to you? The less I know from you, the more options I have. When you tell me the truth, you limit me to a defense that lines up with what you have to say.
But isn't the truth the simplest way, Alan? I mean, why did I stay all day at Sonny's side without calling a doctor? Because Sonny detested doctors. If we called one without her approval, she went berserk. Once she broke her hip and didn't go to hospital for 2 full days.
Klaus, did you hear what I just said?
Of course. Did you hear the judge sentence me?
Sorry. 30 years is a pretty stiff sentence.
Twice trying to murder one's wife, anything less would be monstrous. But for a man like myself, who did nothing.
Jeremy Irons as Klaus von Bülow. Jeremy Irons, tell me what you did with your voice to convey that sense of class privilege, you know, of someone who, like Klaus von Bülow, has a lot of money and seems to be able to use his voice and his eyes to convey his stature and put people in their place.
Well, Klaus, he wasn't English, he was Danish, and so he had a hidden accent that he was trying. He wanted, a bit of a snob, I think, and wanted to very much be part of London society and to sound very English. But there were some things that he couldn't do, a couple of sounds he couldn't make, because he'd been brought up speaking a different tongue.
What sounds do you remember?
The W is always a little bit difficult if you're not used to them. But I wanted him to sound almost more English than the English, but with this slight problem on a couple of consonants.
Now, you pitched your voice deeper than it was at the time.
Yeah. I wanted to give him a sort of gravity. I mean, Klaus was, I think, about 15 years older or maybe 20 years older than I was. So we had to find ways to give me the weight of those years. We thinned my hair. I took my voice down lower. I want it to have a sort of slimy charm. I remember talking to women who knew Klaus, and some of them actually told you an awful lot about the women, more about the women than about Klaus, really, because some of them adored him, and some of them found him so repellent that they couldn't sit next to him. And that is very interesting. It tells you a lot about what women find attractive in men.
Did you have to have in your mind whether you thought he was guilty or innocent as you were playing him?
Well, I didn't have to have in my mind whether I thought he was. I had to know whether I was guilty or innocent. I mean, he knew, and I was him. So, yes, of course I had to know.
And what did you believe that he believed?
I believed he was innocent, but I didn't want the audience to know that.
Right.
Because his friends were divided in life about his guilt or his innocence. I think he carried a certain amount of guilt. In my opinion, he carried the guilt of a man who had left his wife too long before calling for help. But you have to remember, this is a wife who had no desire to live, and who, when the first time he pulled her back from a suicide attempt, she gave him a very, very hard time. And so when somebody tries to do it again, what do you do? If somebody wants out, you know, it's very hard to stop them. And as a husband, you keep pulling them back, especially if you're having an unhappy time with each other.
Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with Jeremy Irons. He's starring with Al Pacino in a new film version of The Merchant of Venice.
Now, I know one of your early roles was in the 60s rock musical Godspell.
You don't have to laugh when you say that.
You were John the Baptist. What were your songs?
Prepare Ye the Way of the Lord, All for the Best, and then the other ones that we sang together.
Sing a few lines of one of them.
Oh. Some men are born to live at ease, doing what they please, richer than the bees are in honey, never growing old, never feeling cold. Well, I can't remember it, it's so long ago. I could hardly remember it then. but it was a tap number. It was the first show I ever did in London, and it was the show during which, I suppose I'd been an actor for about 6 years by then, 7 years, it was the show during which that I knew I had entered the right profession.
Right. Now, I understand you were also a busker for a while, and that you'd perform on the street, sometimes in movie lines. What kind of songs would you do then?
Oh, Bob Dylan, Peter, Paul and Mary. Good old folk songs, you know.
Do you have a guitar?
Yeah, I do. I do. I rarely travel without it. And it means a lot to me. When I travel, I like to travel with a musical instrument. I like to be able to sit and relax and sing. At that time, I was not smoking, and so when I, instead of lighting a cigarette, I'd pick up the guitar. And it's difficult to smoke when you're playing the guitar. And I would spend the evening sitting with friends, drinking, playing the guitar, and not smoking.
No, I'm glad you mentioned smoking, because I always wondered, you know, I gave up smoking years ago. I always wondered, like, if I were an actor, which I'm not, and I had given up smoking, and I had to smoke for a movie, would I get hooked all over again? Have you had to encounter that?
I have, interestingly, yes, because I stopped for 2 years, and I'm very, very ashamed of the fact that I've taken it up again. But I stopped for 2 years while I was making Lolita, because I wanted to put on weight for Humbert. I didn't want him to be gaunt. And I find that I eat more when I don't smoke, and I do put on weight. And I was also not smoking through Chinese Box, and I had to smoke a cigarette in that. We were in Hong Kong. I said, will you get me one of those vegetable cigarettes, you know, that don't have any nicotine, any tobacco in them. And they couldn't get them out there. So eventually I said, oh, well, I'll just have a normal cigarette. And I smoked the normal cigarette during the scene, didn't much enjoy it, and it had no effect at all, which is interesting. However, when I went back onto cigarettes again afterwards, I just had the one, and within a week I was back to 30 a day.
Yeah.
So you know, I think when you're playing a character, you're somewhere else.
Right, right.
Do you know?
Right. I want to move on to another movie, Dead Ringers, which you made in 1988, directed by David Cronenberg. And you played a dual role in this, identical twin gynecologists who kind of exchange identities when they want to with each other in both their professional lives and in their love lives. But they're also kind of mad, particularly one of them. And in this scene, one of the brothers has gotten hooked on prescription drugs, uppers and downers, and the other brother's trying to detox him by keeping him in the house and standing watch over him, making sure he doesn't take anything. So this clip starts with the addicted brother who desperately wants a sleeping pill from the other brother. Here we go.
Andy, I can't sleep.
If you're asking me for a sleeper, I'll tell you right now you're not going to get one.
But what am I going to do then?
You'll stay up.
I'll die if I don't sleep.
You'll stay up.
What if I take something when you go home?
I'm staying right here.
What if I take something when you go to sleep?
I won't go to sleep.
How do you stay awake?
I'll take something.
You'll take an up so that I don't take a down. This is crazy.
Bev, don't worry about me. I'm not you.
Great scene. Great film. Jeremy Irons, what was it like playing identical twins who had to look exactly the same yet be distinguishable to the audience watching the movie?
Well, it was a nice game to play. I had to find a way, an internal way, to make them different so that I knew who I was because I felt different, which I did. An internal energy which was placed really in a different place in my body, which made me feel quite different as one to the other. And when I then played one pretending to be the other, I was able to keep the energy in the same place but try to put the mannerisms of the other onto that.
Now, what do you mean by keeping the energy in the same place?
Well, have you ever done anything like the Alexander? You've done yoga?
I've done Alexander, yeah.
Alexander, right. Well, you know about, you know, the feeling of the energy coming up the spine and out of the top of the head.
Right.
Which pulls you up. So you know about placing energies within yourself.
What Jeremy Irons is talking about is a kind of a body placement posture technique that I think a lot of actors and musicians study.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Reiki massage uses it. I mean, energy points and whatever. And I would put the energy of one of the twins in my forehead, which is sort of where the third eye is, and it's a very powerful place. It makes you stand in a particular way. It makes you live very much on the front foot, gives you great energy, a little bit of aggression, makes your eyes sparkle. It just feels very bright, a bright place to have the energy. And that was for one of the twins, for Elliot. And the other one, I put his energy in his Adam's apple, in his throat, which makes everything different, makes the posture different, makes the sound, the energy within the voice different, and takes some of the energy out of the eyes and just changes everything. And so by moving it from one to the other, I could make these guys apparently different and understandable to the audience. It was a simple trick.
Now, when you were shooting scenes with the two brothers in the same scene, would you shoot the scene alternating back and forth between the two brothers, or shoot just all one brother and then shoot all the other brother?
Yeah, there weren't many scenes like that where they were both in the same, well, both in the same shot. We used the motion control camera when that was necessary, which is an interesting process. But no, I would do one brother and then I'd go and change into the other brother and come on and do the other side. I had a tremendous stand-in who would be my eye line as the other brother, so that I would be looking at in the right place, although eventually that person would not be there and I would be there. A very selfless role he had, because he had to sublimate his own ego completely.
Now, this is a very creepy movie. There are scenes...
Isn't it creepy?
Oh,
well,
yeah.
I can't bear to see it.
Very creepy. I think especially creepy for women to watch. You know, these are gynecologists who have created these really weird instruments to use for internal gynecological exams. And they're obsessed with the insides of bodies and the inner beauty and the inner ugliness of bodies. And they're convinced that some insides are really deformed and other insides are really beautiful. What kind of reactions did you get from women who you know who saw the movie?
Well, before I did the movie, everybody said, don't touch it. My wife and my agent, who are both women, said, don't touch it. This is hopeless. And I knew that it would be a lot of fun for an actor to play two identical twins. I mean, it's a great challenge, that, and so I wanted to do it for that reason. when people then saw the movie, they were sort of hideously fascinated, the women especially. I think they, you know, I think when you see any movie, you think there, but for the grace of God go I. And many women who had to go in for examinations thought, well, at least my gynecologist is not like that.
A small consolation.
But I'm always fascinated that that is the piece of work of mine which people keep going back to and say that, you know, that really was the apogee, which is nice.
Well, Jeremy Irons, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Jeremy Irons speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. He appears opposite Al Pacino in a new screen adaptation of The Merchant of Venice.